Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I'm your host. And once again, I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show goes with me through the adventures of my laptop lifestyle as I move around Las Vegas, known to some, at least me, as the hottest city in the world. Where do you go when you find those inspirations and have those mastermind conversations and meet those unique people who share things that change your life, adjust your trajectory, bring you that much closer to your intersection of your brilliance and your passion? And what do you hear in the background? You may hear the occasional bird chirping and flapping around. You may hear a vehicle rolling in the distance. You may hear ambient noise from the next table. We take you those places because we go those places. Right now, I'm coming to you from my high-tech studio, which happens to be my laptop out here on the table on the balcony, enjoying a very, very nice day here in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I'm looking forward to a conversation with Brian Weaver, who is the CEO of a company called Torch AI, which we're going to hear about. This is going to be one of those conversations we have occasionally where we get to discover a bit more about an entrepreneurial leader. And just through their story and through some of what they've experienced, discover things that can help us move forward by example, by inspiration, and by comparison. So let me tell you about Brian here real quick before we bring him in. As I mentioned, he serves as the CEO of Torch AI. He has more than 20 years experience leading mission-driven, high-growth, technology-focused companies. Torch AI helps leading organizations leverage artificial intelligence in a unique way via a proprietary enterprise data management software solution. Today, Torch AI supports clients like H&R Block with fraud detection and mitigation, and the U.S. Department of Defense with machine learning-enabled background investigations for all federal employees, supporting the determination of an individual's trustworthiness and security credentialing. So, Brian Weaver, come on in. The weather's fine.
Yeah, great to be here, Adam. Thank you for the kind introductions. Fun.
Right off the top, I'm not sure if I'm worthy to be here, and this is my show. You have a bit of a background here that I think is a really great story, and we'd like to sort of have you tell us about that. So, I read off the current part of your official bio, which I said very impressive. I stand humbled. But tell us a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Yeah, this is kind of fun because I was just nominated or am a finalist at the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. And I just literally a few days ago went through a bit of my journey with that whole crew. They do a pretty extensive on-site and interview process, and it's been fun. So anyway, it was funny because it started with my first business. I had a lawn company as a kid with one of my best friends in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was always entrepreneurial. I think I just had that in my bones. My family has been like that. My parents were not, but in our sort of extended family, we've got a lot of entrepreneurs and business owners, and I think it was just one of those things where I was a frustrated employee. I think maybe a little bit differently than the average human. I kind of live in the future, which is both good and bad. And that's not a statement, you know, an egocentric statement or even something to be proud of necessarily. It just is. And so I've always, you know, just been one of these curious people that maybe sees the world a little bit differently. And so when I would start working or or start working with customers that had problems, I really started to enjoy imagining how to remove friction from their life, how to optimize workflows, how to improve decisions. And as I got older and a little smarter, that's typically kind of took the form of mathematics and dealing with information at speed and scale. And that's really what has guided my career. So, you know, I think a little bit of the answer is just I'm wired like that. You know, I'm just this kind of curious person. And I love to kind of get in the mud of a problem. So anyway, I think that's a bit of me. And then, you know, I'm happy to, you know, share sort of trials and tribulations that I kind of started my first company. And that might be a fun story for everybody today.
Yes, yes, yes. We love the stories. Tell us about it. I'm on the edge of my seat here, my friend.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of an entrepreneur in my first two jobs. I tried to start companies inside my employers, and that's kind of, there's antibodies against that, right? A company needs operational efficiency and excellence. And when you have some creative spirit, seeing things, new opportunities, and trying to disrupt, that doesn't always sit well. So I was one of these frustrated entrepreneurs in the beginning. But I ended up doing a deal with a NASCAR track in Kansas City called Kansas Speedway. And I didn't know it at the time, but everybody else had turned it down. And I was like the last guy they asked. And it all revolved around doing marketing to fans to try and increase the track's ability to sell season tickets, to renew season tickets. And so it was really fun, yeah. Really complicated problem. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of fans. I mean, it's still, even today, a Super Bowl weekend every time a race happens all across America. And so what I did was I actually had this idea that I could hire actuaries from Sprint, the big telephone company that's now owned by T-Mobile. And I hired all these people to develop a bunch of models, patterns of life, where I could watch what a fan was doing and predict whether they liked the race and liked Kansas City and or Chicago or wherever, and a propensity to make a decision to buy a season ticket. And then I could send them content to stimulate a different behavior. And it, you know, what is now called programmatic advertising, but 20 years ago was revolutionary, is something I kind of invented there. And so anyway, I did that, and it made the company I worked for a whole bunch of money. But again, antibodies, I did it without permission, even though it was very profitable and made the company millions of dollars. And I actually got reprimanded for it. And it was that moment where I was like, wow, I can't be an employee here anymore. This doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
So the next step, because I'm, you know, even though I'm probably the least risk averse person you'll ever meet in your life. I'm not, careless. And so my next step was to try and convince NASCAR to hire me to do this, all over the place. And they said, yeah, yeah, that'd be great. But they didn't want to pay anything. Because they have the luxury of having an endless list of fans that would love to be an employee and be close to the sport. And so my solution was to start my first company and sort of institutionalize this and commercialize the concept. And I did that. And so it was really bumpy. That whole journey was very bumpy because I struggled to get to expand it. And that's a whole other interesting story. But the net of it is it ended up over a 3 or 4 year period being incredibly successful. It grew exponentially and you know, moved me up in atmospheres in terms of, you know, personal wealth and experience as a business owner. And on the heels of that, I actually acquired my last employer. So the company that gave me the reprimand and in fact, the person that gave the reprimand, I acquired that company. With the cash from the idea that I started while working for them.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of my first chapter of my journey as an entrepreneur, kind of a fun way to get things going when you're 25 years old.
Oh, that's hilarious. So they thought they had you. Oh, we reprimanded Brian. Then you just come around and buy their company.
That's exactly what happened. I was literally sitting in the back seat of my brother's car down in Tampa, Florida. And I made a bid on the business, and I wrote a little heartfelt letter and I'm not a spilt milk person, and I don't really carry any animosity towards anybody ever. It was a great thing. Right. I've had a series of setbacks in my life that all have created, you know, these amazing opportunities that if not for the setback, I wouldn't have it. And that pressure and your ability to be resilient and react to stress and all that stuff, I think that's what ultimately will determine your success as a human, not just a business owner or entrepreneur. So that was a fun moment. It's pretty extraordinary. Literally my wife and I pulled up to the building, when we bought the company and walked in and said, hey guys, welcome back. I mean, it was a fun moment for sure.
Wow. That would be like a dream for me to be able to pull something like that off. I mean, I'm a humanist as well, and I wouldn't be out looking for vengeance or anything, but it's just so funny to see those moments where the table turns or the wheel turns. And I think it's a test of a lot of things, not only our character, but in some ways our sense of humor, to be able to see how this happens. I made the observation 10 years ago when it seemed like at the time I had a lot of clients who were off and on with me, that it seemed like, you know, I would leapfrog ahead of them, they'd hire me. I would leapfrog ahead of them, they would hire me. Then they'd leapfrog ahead of me, and sometimes I hired them. And then it would just go back and forth and back and forth, where seemed like we were all moving forward, but at different paces and having need for each other's support and services at different times.
Yeah, that's life, right? I mean, I think Oprah Winfrey said it, and I bootlegged it at a graduation ceremony where, I gave the commencement speech, but it's when you're looking forward, you don't see the path. But when you turn around and look backwards, you see how all the little twists and turns connect. I think it's absolutely true. And it's also, by the way, in your 20s and 30s, you're building a network of people that are sort of lashed together. And in your 40s and 50s, it's that network that creates the foundation of your, future success. And so if you're not making hay and getting to know people and developing really good, healthy relationships in your 20s and 30s, you're going to struggle in your 40s and 50s because you don't have that network to lean against. And at the end of the day, life is 100% about relationships with other humans and the quality of those relationships. If they're good, as you say, this kind of the Foyle and Perry, kind of dance that you're talking about with these coworkers you've had. That only exists when you generally are giving others energy. You're not selfish, but you kind of believe in a bit of a balanced approach and you approach life, with a positive attitude and a giving attitude. I think that that energy comes back to you. So that's fun. And I agree with the sentiment.
Yeah. And I also know that particularly within the past 20 to 30 years, there have been so many changes. And you and I, I don't think we're too far apart age-wise. So I'm not sure exactly what generational cohort you're in. I myself am at the tail end of Gen X right before the millennials kicked in. So age-wise, I'm a late Gen Xer. I've been called a cusper. Work style-wise, I tend to lead toward the millennials. So just a little bit about me, since what we're doing here is sort of having a bit of an impromptu mastermind for our listeners about our respective journeys, is I went to undergrad. I went to Penn State. I had my degree in political science. My original plan was to become an attorney and go to law school. I didn't end up doing that. I went through a couple of really awful jobs right after I graduated from Penn State, one of which was so bad that I celebrate the day that I was fired from it as my second birthday, April 27th. It's one of the topics of the chapter that I contributed to Journeys to Success, the Millennial Edition. And yeah, I got people like one of my buddies from college razzed me. He's like, oh, you're a millennial all of a sudden. That's funny. I thought you were a Gen Xer like me. It's like, well, I don't know. I was invited to participate in the project and it was a lot of fun. So for those of you who have been fired a time or two, yes, I'm an example of somebody who literally wrote a book about it, so to speak. Oh, I wrote a chapter about it. It was featured in an Amazon international bestseller, so take that. I went for my MBA at Duquesne University. I received it. I did that program full-time at the same time that I held down a full-time job. After I graduated, I spent 2 years going back and forth, sort of, between, you know, I have this side hustle I've started. Do I want to go full-bore entrepreneurial? Do I want to climb the ladder with this company where I've been promoted diagonally since I graduated? Which way am I going here? And ultimately, the decision was made for me when I realized, and I'm actually going to be very nice here because I think about the demographics of every episode that we record here. Let's just say that my boss's bosses was lacking by every measure. And that became very apparent to me. And that kind of made the decision that I was going to go all the way with the entrepreneurial thing. Now, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have sat there for 2 years. I wouldn't have sat there for 2 weeks. In fact, I was given a way out and I didn't recognize what it was simply because I didn't know what I didn't know and I didn't know what questions to ask. When I finally did make the move, I never looked back and I found myself very quickly in an industry I didn't expect to be in, that there was a lot of opportunity. I made a lot of money with it, but it wasn't, you know, we all go through these journeys and it's not for nothing that in the entrepreneurial space, I suggest that a company should rebrand itself every 3 to 5 years for two reasons. Number one, it refreshes you on the marketplace. Number two, it enables you to embrace innovations without having to say, oh, well, we didn't know. It allows you to say you're embracing the cutting edge because people are funny with what they hear sometimes. So those are a couple of my observations. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, Gen X considered sort of a cusper. And I guess that mentally I'm almost millennial in a sense, and I've covered this so many times. I don't think millennials are lazy at all. I mean, millennials I see are some of the most innovative, passionate, brilliant people that you can have in the workplace, you can have as entrepreneurs. They're just the first generation that had access to information that enabled them to question narratives and to formulate goals in such a way where they can recognize that work is not just something you do to fulfill requirements so you can live. It's the opportunity to make the world a better place by being part of it. If a company doesn't provide that for them, they're just more likely to move on elsewhere because there is no gold watch and there is no shack in Fort Lauderdale. That went away a long time ago.
I don't know. I think when you look at consumerism, that certainly there's a different approach to work and work expectation. I think finding your purpose is something that this younger generation, I've got, you know, teenage daughters that are amazing. I employ a bunch of millennials. And what I found is that they actually are a lot more diligent, disciplined, and traditional than you'd think. I think the key thing that they question, and that really, frankly, you know, as a squarely Gen X person, what they've encouraged all of us to do is to make sure that you live with purpose, not just work with purpose, but you live with purpose. And there's a heightened interest in kind of the why, not just the what. And I think the other thing I would say is that's a little counter to some of these perceptions is that when you look at consumer spending and you look at how the lifestyles have shifted around, there still is a very big pull. I mean, look at some of the brands that are the most profitable that have survived. I mean, look at expensive watches, look at expensive cars, look at homes all through the pandemic. You know, what's happened? The scarcity of supply chain, is wreaking havoc on our economy. And it's, you know, why is that? It's because every generation is prioritizing enjoying certain things, right? Things made with purpose, things with value, things that relate to something that are more personal to them. And so I think it's a really extraordinary time to sort of vacuum up all of that data and make sense of it, and not just fall into these traps of labels of these generations and these preconceived notions of you know, how they're working, or you know, or some magazine article someone might have read.
Yeah.
Kind of labeling this bucket of age groups. I mean, I you know, again, I'm a data person and a mathematics person, right? So I live in fact, the bucket of facts and contextual relationships. That's how I see the entire world, as one big network. And it's not one thing. It's not tribes of people. It's actually one big system, one big complex ecosystem, a big complex network of behaviors. And they're all related to each other. And so maybe I just have a little different perspective than you do on that, but I'm encouraged by it, and it's helped me. You know, I've gone through health issues. I've gone through personal financial setbacks and professional setbacks and all that kind of stuff. And it does make you think, you know, and kind of prioritize certain things and change your perceptions of what reality is.
Yeah. If we want to look at the generations just for a moment, I agree with you that just simply saying, well, all the millennials act this way, all the Gen Zers act this way, all the Gen Xers act this way, all the Gen Yers are this. That's not the case. Now, first of all, they do learn from each other. And second, we are now seeing it permeate upward in the generational slope. So they like to say, well, these lazy millennials. Well, now we're seeing the Gen Xers and even some of the baby boomers who are still in the workplace and still leading companies and still doing entrepreneurial things. They're now saying, oh, but what about me? What about my purpose? I'd like to have a purpose here. I'd like to do more than draw a paycheck. I'd like to make the world a better place by me being part of it. I'd like to not deal with being in a factory situation in an office environment. I'd like to be creative. I'd like to contribute, be recognized, and know that the work that I'm doing is benefiting the company, benefiting the world, and that my intersection of my brilliance and my passion. So I think that's great. 20 years ago, when I first completed the MBA, and I knew that one way or another, I was not going to stay at that company that I'd worked at for 2 years for a whole long time. Just due to the nature of the industry they were in, I was kind of hitting a ceiling in terms of how far I could even go with that. Plus, my MBA was in something else entirely. So I just mentioned a situation to a friend of mine at the time, and he told me that, this I remember what he said. He said, well, of course you're leaving that company. You've been there, what, 2 years? You sit there much longer and people are going to wonder what the hell you're doing just working at one place. Like, aren't you going anywhere? Don't you have anything on the ball? Are you just a time server? And that was really one of the first times I'd heard that. It's like, what, you're not, you know, well, but doesn't that make me seem like I'm unstable if I'm bouncing from company? No. If you're not bouncing from company to company, then you're not innovative. You're not dynamic. You're not moving places. You're not cutting edge in the industry. The employer is going to look at that and they're going to say, what the hell are you doing just sitting there? What are you, a time server? Is it even worth having a conversation with you in an interview? And that was a bit of a shock to me, because I was still part of being told, you find a company, you stay loyal to them for 40 years, you get your 401k and your savings and all that. Like, yeah, I understand retirement savings. I have all that as well, but that's not what I'm in it for. Growing my 401k or my Roth IRA or anything like that does not motivate me to do more episodes of the Business Creators Radio Show. Let's just put it that way.
Well, yeah,
I think that's one of the shifts we've seen.
We all hope that's not the case. Yes.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are your listeners typically like when you get feedback on the show? Like, what's everybody, what are the comments typically? What resonates with folks?
Ooh, turning the tables. I like this. I wish more guests would do this. Okay. The Business Creators Radio Show, since you want to pick my brain a little bit. Ooh, I've been looking for somebody to do this. This is so great. We have identified a few unique audience segments for our show, one of which are startups that are moving into revenue. That's one area. Another are solopreneurs who are moving into becoming a leveraged organization with employees, virtual teams, contractors, technologies, etc. And then a third segment are those who are moving from 6 to 7 digits in terms of annual gross revenues. Those are the three areas that we seem to hit for a certain reason. As far as the nature of our episodes, what our listeners tend to like most is when I occasionally completely spaz out and say at least five out of seven of the forbidden words because I can. They enjoy, and again, it's just feedback I get, when we get into the stories that reveal our humanity and what we discover by going through the journey of life. And what they also really tend to enjoy are those little aha moments that make them think, wow, I never saw it that way before. Up until now, I just did not have the frame of reference to even have that idea.
Mm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I think this is kind of what I had said to you earlier before that we got on the show. And what I found really fascinating, one, and two, kind of personally rewarding, is sharing a little bit of the trials and tribulations of going from that zero to your first million, or from your first million to your first 10 million or whatever, and how hard it is, because it's a grind. And what's funny is now I'm in an atmosphere where we're approaching 100 million. And that in one company that I have, and so that whole thing, it's still very similar. It just gets a little more complex, but the effort and the you know, mental gymnastics are very similar. I don't know. That's a great audience you have, and certainly a completely valiant effort when you kind of get a business going as a sole proprietor and you turn it into an actual enterprise, you know, that can grow and scale and support, you know, helping more people. I think that's always a good focus. So yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. And you've built and acquired companies, you've built and led teams yourself. And I remember when I first got into this whole leverage virtual team thing, I was about a year and a half in. And basically, the mentoring I got over it is from a surface level was, well, you can't be doing any of this stuff yourself. You got to hire people to do A, B, C, D, and E. The biggest problem I had was I had a company at the time that I owned that had about, I think, between 40 and 50 clients. So all of my clients got assigned project managers. And then within the project managers, we had support teams to work on each client's needs. And I had a few of my clients say, well, I didn't sign up to work with a team or a project manager. I signed up for you. So either I work with you personally or I leave. And I said, okay, bye-bye, toodaloo, see ya. And there were, it was because of the way they said it. It was very condescending. Like, they had some ownership stake in my company and could tell me how to run my operations. No, that didn't quite work. Now, then we had the ones who went out of their way to ignore the people within my organization who were supposed to be supporting them, actually take emails that their project manager would send to them, remove the project manager and reply to me as if to say, I'm only dealing with you. And it's like, okay, this kind of passive aggressive subterfuge doesn't work. So those are the outliers. I want to identify them just to set them aside. But yeah. I think what I have discovered when it comes to team building is that, and my phrasing here is not going to be perfect, but we'll get by as best we can. We see a focus on things like organizational charts and assignment of duties. And yeah, all that matters to a degree. But what often gets left out of that conversation is what I refer to as the individual's intersection of their brilliance and their passion, and also allowing for roles and responsibilities to morph as people bring things to the table that we weren't expecting to hear from them. you ever encountered that? You brought somebody onto your team and you were just amazed, like, wow, if I'd have known that you had that capability or that brilliance, this could have gone a lot differently.
Yeah, what I found in my career, and I've managed, you know, I started my first company when I was basically 25 years old, right? And so I've managed and hired and fired and,
yeah,
you know, all the other things in between, hundreds and hundreds of people as an entrepreneur, right? And these are my companies. It's not like I'm a CEO, a hired gun CEO that manages thousands and thousands of people. These are things that I, you know, invested in, started, you know, some of which are I've sold, some of which I shuttered. So the point is, I think what I learned in all that, the journey, that permutation of it really being you, like when you work for a bigger company, there's this amorphous company. But when you're an entrepreneur and a founder, it's you, and you are responsible for everything. Everything that happened before, everything that's about to come. And it's fascinating. So what that means then is that you learn these lessons in a unique way, because right. They are literally everything that goes wrong in the company is a manifestation of some flaw of yours as a leader, as a manager, as a human, whatever. And so what I found, my biggest impediment, and probably the biggest aha that I ever had with people, was realizing that there's different modes of operation. My mode is to quickly, I'm probably faster than you've ever met anybody at seeing opportunities and pitfalls. I'm kind of off the charts that way. And so it's a blessing and a curse, but I see things for what they are very, very quickly. And I don't need a lot of historical context in order to understand the current landscape. And then I immediately go as kind of my second mode of operation into the details, the physical manifestation of whatever the problem is or whatever the opportunity might be and what a solution might ultimately look like, the actual shape, color, button size of whatever a solution might look like, right? The world, and especially in a technology business, you know, I'm surrounded by people that their first mode is to go back to what's been done, the history, and understand with incredible clarity what has historically worked. And once they have that comfort about around what's happened and what's worked, they then and only then can they move forward and start moving into their second mode, which is typically to develop a bit of a checklist, because engineers are very thoughtful and they're disciplined and process oriented. And an entrepreneur, especially one like me, is the complete polar opposite. So I had a lot of friction. I mean, I was stressed and frustrated with people, and it wasn't because they lacked brain power or you know a will to do good or they were bad employees. It literally was they just operated different than I did, and I did not see that, and I had an immaturity about me that didn't appreciate their gift of actually going to the past, something I didn't need, but something that if you're really going to build a great business, you have to factor that in because it eliminates risk.
Yeah.
And so instead of seeing that as a negative, as an impediment to forward progress, I realized that I was the impediment to forward progress because I wasn't fully appreciating the gift of that and the tool that can be for a guy like me who you know, will move with a high tolerance for risk and without a lot of contextual value for the past. And once I figured that out, man, it unlocked my world because I was like, instead of fighting, you're like, wow. These people need me to guide them and to help them use their talent to, you know, the talent they were born with to help the company and the collective succeed. And I would say that often it's a failure of a leader, whether it's a manager at a company, certainly a founder or a CEO of a company that sets the tenor and tone of the culture and business. To really fully appreciate everybody's individual mode of operation, not whether they're smart or not, whether they're a good worker or not, whether they do stupid stuff during the day. I'm talking about their fundamental mode of operation. Like, how do they approach a problem? Do they start in the future and work backwards? Do they start in the past and work forwards? You know, do they start with a checklist? You know, do they start tinkering? Do they start whiteboarding? And that mode is different for everybody. And once you realize that, and actually kind of start figuring out people and paying attention, the game changes entirely. And so I think that's one really fascinating aspect about, you know, kind of my life and career that's helped unlock, you know, frankly, millions and millions of dollars of personal wealth because I'm more efficient and effective as a leader. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's just a plain fact.
Well, don't hate to say it. Love to say it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What one of the things I share, and this is a bit more micro than your macro view, I've done well over 500 episodes of the Business Creators Radio Show. I have other podcast projects where I've interviewed hundreds of people. I've interviewed people as guest presenters on webinars, on teleseminars. I've been a guest and a presenter myself on hundreds of different places. Through those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of experiences, one thing that I have acquired is an almost instinctual ability to know how, if like when somebody logs in to do the Business Creators Radio Show as a guest, like you, Brian, for example, I know within 2 seconds of you logging in how the interview is going to go.
Huh.
Based on the very first thing the person says when they log in, I know exactly what I'm dealing with. And then I know how to use that to make it as awesome an experience as possible for the guest and for our listeners. To me, there's really no such thing as bad. The only things that anybody can do on the Business Creators Radio Show that are bad are try and push me around on my own show and tell me how to run it and to answer every question by, say, buy my course at such and such link. Those are really the only things that somebody can do wrong. Outside of that, I'm looking to meet you where you are.
Yeah.
And what's,
yeah, but what's that mean? You know, like,
yeah.
You know, how, I mean, meeting them where they are, but you have to have like a, you have to have a method to understand where they are.
Sure.
That's a key aspect.
Yeah. That would be our pre-interview green room. And also the way that we gather data about our guests, whether they're applying for themselves or applying through their agency representatives, and the level and specifics of the information we're provided through that process also give me a lot of intelligence. So in your case, what I love about our conversation is we're sharing stories about our journeys, and you and I are in two different places serving two different markets. Not only is that fantastic, but it gives opportunities for cross-learning that you don't get every day when you're within people of your own cohort.
Yes. Yeah.
So what I am curious about, and this is me indulging my geek tendencies for just a moment. I know that you do work with artificial intelligence, and I know I'm asking almost a newbie question, but, you know, what... I mentioned that your work with H&R Block and fraud detection and the Department of Defense and background investigations, but what do you see currently as some of the opportunities and some of the breakthroughs in artificial intelligence that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on the pointy end, our business in particular and our focus on artificial intelligence is a very advanced form of automating tasks, right? But they're very, very complex. And so we are not an academic institution. So there's a lot of really interesting R&D that's happening in this space. And we're in the business of applied AI. So we have customers that use artificial intelligence to optimize a human task or a procedure or process, or detect things, you know, doing some really interesting things and even in some cases create, things using artificial intelligence. So we're at kind of the pointy end of the marketplace with the complexity, and sophistication of the machine learning that we use here. I think some of the most interesting, aspects of AI is something called artificial general intelligence. And so when you think about a lot of the AI and ML that happens today are an automation of a single task. You know, I need to detect a person walking across a crosswalk if I'm a car and I'm building an autonomous driving capability. Well, there's a discrete task that says, look for an object in the path of the car.
Yeah.
And that's an object detection task, right? So that's a simple kind of way to think about AI or ML. or the prediction, for example, that if I'm on Facebook and looking at content or whatever, that I might be in the mood for a chocolate bar today, right? That's a pattern detection kind of capability. So I think when you think of artificial general intelligence, it's actually like a brain that is flexibly applied to a problem set. So I can use the same block of learning to translate text, to decipher what an object is, to play a game. And the promise of artificial general intelligence is really fascinating when you get into the complexities of it, right? So it's can I take software code and mathematics and use it the same way a human brain does? Like, I can throw you and your eyeballs and your sensory organs into an environment and you'll make sense of it. And that is what artificial general intelligence is the ability for technology to basically understand its environment and start automating tasks in an intelligent way to solve a problem where the problem isn't, you know, sort of preconceived. And then the other piece is quantum computing. And so when you start thinking of the concept of artificial general intelligence being impeded by the computational capability, how many mathematical computations can I make in a second, and how quantum kind of turns the potential of that on its head. Those two concepts combined, I think, are really fascinating to think about what's possible in the next decade or two. Because I think it is. I think it's about a 20-year journey to fully realize that. Data availability and data usability is the biggest impediment. That's what our business focuses on. One of the biggest impediments to applying a machine to a task is that data today is very, very difficult to use. And it's getting exponentially harder to use at literally every single day. So where we pay attention at Torch is that the data that's being fed into an AGI platform or even a task, oriented platform, the data is so fragile and hard to use that's where we have focused all of our R&D efforts on really creating a platform that can automatically detect what the data is and prepare it in such a way using AI to make all the downstream machine learning tasks more efficient and less expensive, frankly. And so it's a fascinating landscape. It's in some ways mature. It's been around. The concept's been around for a long time, but it's accelerating in just a tremendous way. And so it's a really fun market to be in. It's fun from an intellectual perspective. And it's really, really fun when you have clients like an H&R Block or like Lockton Insurance or the U.S. federal government that is, really, frankly, is probably the biggest pioneer in this space, even though we get criticized. The U.S. is the biggest, the government is the biggest pioneer in this space by far. And I think it's a really fun and personally rewarding and place to be. It allows me to live with purpose, right? It's been a gift that I've gotten and kind of a fun part of life.
Yeah, I think that's great. And, artificial intelligence does involve itself in our lives in ways that some of us see on the surface, like the old, and I've seen this meme probably a couple times today and it's still early. Hey, I was just thinking about toasters. I was thinking about having toast with my breakfast. And oh, now you're seeing ads for toasters. You're seeing ads for breakfast. You're seeing ads for restaurants. It's like, I didn't type anything on a computer. I don't remember saying this to anybody.
Yeah.
How'd you read my mind?
Yeah. Yeah. That's classic pattern detection, you know? Yeah.
So is it something that we don't say or something that those kind of thoughts influences us to put out there that triggers artificial intelligence to know that could be on our mind?
So the whole idea here is that like we have a customer that has to process a form, and before we showed up, they had trouble processing all these forms, and it was a customer service problem they were having. And the forms were killing it. And actually the people hated their jobs and they were quitting and all this stuff because it was just this arduous thing, right? Messing around with PDFs and documents, and the job sucked. And so we show up, and it by the way, it took a month to get a single customer project done because The data was kind of messy and all that. And so we show up and we say, hey, you know, the reason your people are frustrated is it's too complex. There were literally nearly 9,000 versions of forms that they had to figure out how to use. Think about that. A human can't possibly understand it. So, but the world doesn't think like this. If I'm an athlete and I'm going to kick a field goal, I'm going to try and create the most controlled environment I possibly can for my kicker, right? But yeah. In business, they don't do that. In business, we create the most complex environment for work to get done. And then what we do is we say, oh, well, shoot, we just need more people because we're moving too slow. The answer is pile more people on. And it's actually, you know, it's this slippery slope because it makes the whole problem worse. It exacerbates it. So I think the concept here is that a machine has the ability to instantly, like literally sub-second performance, instantly understand all 9,000 permutations of these documents. And it makes that complexity disappear because the machine just moves faster. Now, what's missing is human intuition. But what machines can do is provide context and correlation across all those 9,000 documents. So types of documents, there are 20 million documents or so, but 9,000 types of documents across the 20 million. So what I'm saying is the machine has this capability to create context, mathematical relationships between all these pieces of information. And a human doesn't need to care about that part, but that's what the machine can do. What a human has that a machine does not have, and this is the whole kind of promise of artificial general intelligence, and there's little glimmers of it, which is what gives us all hope, guys like me. But humans have intuition and ingenuity that a machine will probably never truly have. A human has this intuition that is the synthesis of history and again, modes of operation, modes of decision-making, and the ability to synthesize a lot of environmental data that a machine just simply it's impossible to do today. Your eyes can take in information from a photograph in a way that is very similar to your eyes taking in information from a real scene that you're physically in. A machine has trouble figuring out those two things, right? Because the data itself is so highly complex and differentiated, but the human has intuition, and I can intuit that a white shape looks like an owl in a photograph and is an owl in reality. You know, there's something that's missing there. So again, that may be deeper than you want, but I think fundamentally the machine can accelerate the mathematical relationships between information in a way that a human can't do at speed and scale, but the human can then take that machine output and use human intuition and human ingenuity to solve a problem. And that's what I think is really magic about the space that I spend my time in today. It's fun. And that's what we do with our customers. You know, our customers are these amazing people that know their businesses and know their environment. They know what they need out of it. And when we enable and unlock kind of that human ingenuity thing, we unlock the potential of a human. That's something special, and it makes you smile. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah. I never thought of, at least from my own experience, that artificial intelligence could help with form processing in that way. And I think of customer service and some of the experiences we have with that. An opportunity that I see is that artificial intelligence can help make customer service more effective by giving customer service representatives data and helping them to utilize trends and data in ways that we currently don't see. I've written in my book, and I've also shared through experiences with some of my clients, where the people, and I've been this person actually, where I've been on the front lines of customer service with no backup from higher management, no resources provided me to do my job. And then they would come to me and say, why didn't you do your job? For that last company I worked for, in one of my roles with that company, my part of my responsibility, and I was in network contracting, was dealing with cases where members of the health insurance we provided ended up in out of network situations in emergency rooms, and this was and this was dealing with people who are covered under the welfare system in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So in other words, the state was paying for it. Now, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania would only pay certain amounts per day for certain types of services. And there was even a whole chart on this. And it was my job to deliver the great news to these emergency rooms and every state in the nation that, that's really cool. Do you want to bill $7,000 for Mr. Jones's day of inpatient treatment? However, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, based on a combination of its regulations and its analysis of cost of living trends and other factors, will pay $633 a day. Here's the paperwork. Sign it.
Yeah.
And if they didn't sign, then they didn't get paid. And then what would happen is that they would file grievances and it would end up in appeals. And then my superiors would say, these are the same superiors who would stress that I had no room for negotiation whatsoever. They would say, why is this in grievance? Why didn't you negotiate with these people? Like, what? Now, it got to the point, and I'm saying this out loud because it was 20 years ago, and candidly, I don't care at this point. I almost got to the point where I began telling these facility providers how to get what they wanted. And I'm going to reveal it to our listeners because whatever. It's real simple. All you have to do is threaten to sue. And my superiors would fold like cheap lawn chairs and cut the check for whatever you wanted and overnight it to you. Because they didn't want lawsuits. Because lawsuits meant that they were not fulfilling the obligations of their contract, which was to reduce and eliminate the cost of litigation. So imagine being a customer service person in that situation. Imagine working for a web hosting company on the front lines of their tech support, where you know full well that their servers are cracked. Management will not invest more money in upgrading and replacing the servers. And management keeps telling you, oh, when these customers complain, they don't know how to manage WordPress. They install all these plugins. So yeah, their stuff crashes all the time. So don't believe their stories about our servers.
Right.
How much can you beat your fist on a brick wall before you realize it's just too painful? And if you're in the front lines, at what point do you just begin reading scripts? And as much as you'd like to tell the clients the secrets to actually getting service, you know, the call is being monitored and you get fired for doing so, but you want to so bad. Now, what if artificial intelligence, and I know this already exists in certain ways, can help to intervene in some of these situations, even for those customers who don't want to deal with prompts, who want to just press 9 for a representative?
Oh, it does. It does now. I mean, there's.
I was asking rhetorically, but yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, that's a big thing today. Well, again, I think, you know, I know we're coming up on time and we're wrapping up, but I think it's these areas where not only is it automating a lot of tasks to kind of make workers have a better lifestyle using machines to remove, you know, low value work. But it's also ultimately it resolves itself in better customer service, because the one thing is that companies, the most expensive thing for companies is losing existing customers. And so retention is probably the number one priority for a company, especially these larger companies that have these scale issues with customer service issues and things like that. And because of that, they spend literally billions and billions of dollars figuring out how to make the pathway frictionless and optimized for customer delight. And so there's a lot of money pouring into being exploratory in these areas, which is good. That's good for everybody. It's good for workers. It's good for the product companies, and it's good for us as consumers. It's fun.
Yeah,
it's been awesome to spend time with you today, Adam. I mean, I appreciate listening to your stories and likewise,
I love
hearing a bit of mine.
Yeah, I loved hearing about you. I loved hearing about some of the latest in artificial intelligence. And what's really great is every so often we get to have these conversations on the Business Creators Radio Show. So what I want to do is I just want to encourage all of our listeners to visit Brian Weaver's website, just go to www.torch.ai to discover more about Torch AI. It's fascinating what they're doing with artificial intelligence. And also bear in mind some things that Brian is up to. He's a great guy to be connected with. And with that, Brian Weaver, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and, believe me, an education.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Adam. Thanks for sharing a little bit about yourself and again, spending some time with me today. It was fun.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.